It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We've got all the security news, including, oh, man, more problems than you could shake a stick at. A complete indictment, frankly, of Microsoft and their Windows 10 upgrade process, plus 10 of your questions and 10 of Steve's answers. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 561, recorded Tuesday, May 24th, 2016. Your questions, Steve's answers, number 234. Security Now is brought to you by the Ring Video Doorbell. With Ring, you can see and talk to anyone at your door from anywhere in the world using your smartphone. It's like caller ID for your house. Right now, get free expedited FedEx shipping when you go to ring.com/securitynow. And by IT Pro TV. IT Pro TV is an easy, entertaining approach to online IT training. For a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/securitynow and use the promo code SN30. And by Rocket Mortgage, by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century with a fast, easy, and completely online process. Check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/securitynow. It's time for Security Now, the show where we protect you and your loved ones, your privacy, your security online. Thanks to this man right here, a hero for our times. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Steve Gibson. Hi, Steve.
You know, every Tuesday evening after your group pulls it together and gets the audio posted, I download it in order to recompress it for Elaine. And I listen to the beginning of this and I think, you have achieved such consistency through the years. It's, you know, same sort of, you know, rev would, up and go.
Some would call it consistency. Some would call it a kind of a boring sameness.
And also on the tech guy on the weekends, it's, well, hey.
Right. And that I do on purpose. But, you know, that was because I couldn't say good morning or good evening because the tech guy is heard across the country. So I had needed a greeting that was agnostic, time agnostic. Yeah. We even have...
Yeah,
some
so
stations
sort of a Yogi
taped
Bear
delaying
kind
it.
Of thing.
Yeah.
Hey, boo-boo.
Hey, boo-boo.
It's time for a TikTok.
So it's a Q&A day today.
Yeah. We've got lots of fun stuff in the mailbag since we had skipped several Q&As, although we did do a double Q&A 3 weeks ago because, remember, there was so much to talk about. We only got like four done out of the 10 that we had scheduled. So I had 352, I think it was, pieces of unread mail when I dumped the mailbox. And so found some great things. And also, oh, you know, just a crazy week. Not a ton of news, but interesting stuff. There was a surprising end to the Tesla Crypt encrypting malware episode. Google has announced their plans to continue putting the squeeze on Flash, and we'll talk about the details of that. Of course, appeared on the internet for $2,200 was the sale of an additional 117 million old LinkedIn email addresses and passwords from 2012. So we're going to cover the details of that. We have an interesting little tidbit I just could have liked about the underlying technology of Google's announced last week Allo messaging system.
Oh, I can't wait.
Cory Doctorow had been, it turns out, doing a series of posts, and I didn't pick up on it until the most recent one, but it's really significant about the... again, the entertainment industry struggling to close content on the internet. And so I want to talk about, I want to share what he wrote because it's not very long. And that's actually, I think it's really important that we understand at the technical level what he's talking about. And then we've got some fun miscellany and feedback from our listeners. So I think, another great couple hours for our listeners.
And I see behind you that you have received something new and exciting.
Well, yes, when you mentioned the Ring Pro, or I did, someone did last week, because it was on, I'd seen it on Amazon, or I think I'd seen it on their site, and I didn't know what it was. And then I thought, hey, I don't think it's been 4 weeks yet. And sure enough, it had only been three since I ordered it from Amazon, so I was able to return it. And then I went to ring.com/securitynow and saved myself shipping and got the Pro.
Smart man. Yeah. Which, actually, I don't know. Did you save shipping? Because I thought that they said that free shipping only applies to the original Ring. So good. Wow. Good on you.
Yeah.
I don't.
Yeah. Yeah. So and what I like about it is that it is they solve the problem of the bezel coloration. So you get three different bezel
colors. Oh, they just snap
colors.
On bezels. Yeah.
Yeah.
Otherwise, silver, you have to order the one you want. Yeah.
Right. A silver, a brown, and a black. And then the unit itself, or I guess a white, a brown, and a black, and it has the silver one snapped on it already. And as you said last week, basically, there's not a lot of difference, but it is 1080p rather than 720p. So I figured, since I hadn't, you know, drilled any holes yet, I might as well take the time and upgrade to the highest resolution one.
Yeah. Well, let me talk a little bit about this, because it's really, they're our sponsor, as you probably have gathered. The Ring Video Doorbell is really, we've got one. In fact, most of the people who work for Twit now have purchased a Ring Video Doorbell because it's so cool. And so what it is, and I actually have one right here I could show you. It's the idea is you've got this doorbell that is a complete replacement for your existing doorbell. Now, that's wired or unwired, although ours was wired. So I removed the old doorbell. And by the way, they give you all the stuff you need, the screwdriver, the drill bit if you have to drill holes. We didn't because we already had holes. A level. You put this plate there, trim the two wires that come out of the door into the terminals here. This is actually a much nicer install than the existing doorbell was. And then there's the Ring Video Doorbell. And the whole idea of the Ring Video Doorbell, there it is. I'm probably scaring people now by ringing it, is that this ties into your Wi-Fi. It's an Internet of Things device. And then when somebody rings your doorbell, you'll hear that even if you're not at home. I mean, I hear it on my phone. I hear it on my iPad. It's actually great even if you are at home, because I can never hear the doorbell. This way I never miss somebody at the door. And even if I'm home, I can then look and see. Let me launch my Ring Video Doorbell here. This is the software. And you can put it on your iPhone, your Android phone, your Windows phone, and you can see who's coming and going. We left this morning around 10 o'clock, so I imagine this is going to be me and Lisa going out the door as we walked to work. Yep. There it is. And there's the dog, Ozzy. So yours is probably very similar. It's even though it's higher resolution, this is 720p. I think that's fine. I can hear you. Can see you hear us. I could speak to you as well. And so I can answer the doorbell, or even if just somebody's walking by, because this is motion detection. You see, I didn't ring the doorbell. And I can speak to somebody. It also has in the app recordings of every bit of motion and missed rings and rings answered. So you've got it's like a security camera. But it's also kind of a handy thing for answering the doorbell, even if you're not at home. You could say, oh, I'm not here right now, but can you leave the package on the stoop? Or better yet, oh, I'm in the bathtub right now. You know, don't want to tell people you're not home. Actually, that's one thing people use this for. The Ring Video Doorbell is a way to protect your home, too, because it turns out about 95% of home robberies take place during the day. Almost always, the burglar will ring your doorbell to make sure you're not home. Then when you don't answer, goes around back, breaks in, steals your stuff. Now, you're always home, even if you're not home. They ring the doorbell, you go, hello. And even if they don't ring the doorbell, you're going to have crystal clear video of them scoping out your house. The number of people who have solved crimes, people have been arrested, is growing all the time. Even some of our listeners, Nia, one of our chat room listeners, was telling me the Ring Video Doorbell caught somebody in the act for him, too. This is amazing. It's like caller ID for your house, and I want you to check it out. It's about $200, although if you go to ring.com/securitynow, you'll get expedited FedEx shipping for free. So if you want it soon, you want it quick, that's the way to do it. They told me, Steve, that it does not apply, the FedEx shipping does not apply to the Ring Pro. Ring.com/security now. It is awesome. By the way, lifetime purchase protection. If somebody stole your doorbell, no problem. They'd replace it for free. It comes in, as you mentioned, a variety of finishes. If you get the traditional Ring, you actually have to buy the one that matches you. We have on our house the antique brass, because that matches what we've got. The one I showed you is satin nickel. They also have polished brass. Oh, actually, this is the one we have, Venetian bronze. It's darker. Ring.com. Oh, they have a Mac app now, too. I should show you that, and a Windows 10 app. So you can actually watch and answer the doorbell from your computer as well. Ring.com/security now. Steve Gibson, Leo Laporte, let's get to the security news.
So this was really odd. And there are a couple of things that are sort of that strike me as strange about this. We've talked often about this, the so-called Tesla crypt, which was one of the early and I hesitate to use the word successful in the case of file encrypting malware, but it was very successful, meaning that it generated a lot of income for the cretins who created it. And as all of our listeners know, this is something that people would get in their machines infected with inadvertently, and it would identify basically all of their content files, stuff that was the irreplaceable, unreinstallable portion of their world, their doc files, their MP3s, their spreadsheet files, whatever, and encrypt it with a key such and the confounding thing about this was that the technology was well designed. They would it before it did any encryption, it would contact a master server and from the server, which would generate a key pair, it would use public key crypto to encrypt the files such that only the key which could decrypt them, that is the matching asymmetric key, was available on the server. It was never on the victim's computer. So that made the decryption irrevocably one way. There was no way to reverse this after it was done. And believe me, lots of security researchers looked at it carefully. Now, we have talked about some Me Too clones of this that were less well done, where they did leave the key inadvertently around so it could be found and files, other versions or other complete, separate builds, not builds, well, just separate malware that was doing the same kind of thing. So what was covered in the last week was that Tesla Crypt was shutting down. And so in what was a surprising end to this reign and run of Tesla Crypt, an analyst at ESET noting that they were sort of winding operations down.
So weird.
It is.
What, did they make enough money to buy the Tesla, so now they're quitting? Yeah. what's the deal?
I don't get, because in some of the coverage, they talked about Tesla Crypt had been slowly closing its doors while their previous distributors had been switching over to distributing the Crypt XXX ransomware. Huh. So there was another whole family of ransomware, but the notion of having distributors for file encryption malware just
it's a business
boggles.
Now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Boggles my mind. So this ESET researcher posts on Tesla Crypt's support chat asking if, since they were apparently shutting things down, would they consider releasing the master decryption key? And they did.
What?
Now, first of all, I didn't know there was a master decryption key. And in trying to go back and find some early reference to there being one, unfortunately, the only thing Google would show me was like all of the news, the recent news about there being a master decryption key. So, and I didn't spend a lot of time trying to dig into the past. But I don't remember at any point in our coverage there being an idea that there was a galactic, you know, master key. Somehow
that's what they gave the NSA. That was the backdoor key.
Right. Yeah. Somehow this ESET researcher just, he knew or he assumed there was one.
He probably went, you know, he went through the code, obviously, right?
Yeah, and he said, hey, would you guys let that loose? And they said, yeah, sure. So they posted it.
Wow.
So constantly, as a consequence, two things now exist. Over on the bleepingcomputer.com site, which we've been referring to since the beginning of this whole drama with file encrypting malware, because they've been really right on the leading edge of news and coverage. They've got some good forums and lots of good tools and feedback. Someone there, one of their contributors, has created Tesla Decoder version 1.0. And the way the coverage read, it apparently earlier, not, you know, pre 1.0 versions existed, but it wasn't done. So when this master key was released, Tesla Decoder went to version 1.0, and it is now available. I'm not sure how it's valuable, because of course it would require somebody who had maybe never taken never succumbed to the blackmail, decided they could live without their file. So, you know, maybe there are hard drives around that were Tesla crypted, and for whatever reason, ransom wasn't paid, decryption didn't work, they waited too long. Remember, there was the whole timeout. You had like, what, 72 hours, and then after that it was over. We weren't going to help you any longer. So, you know, maybe there are drives around that have, encryption still in place, in which case this is one of two tools that would be able to decrypt those files. The other is that ESET has their own. ESET's site is welivesecurity.com, and they've released a nice-looking command-line, so you fire up a browser, a DOS command shell window, and there's runs in a command-line environment, whereas Tesla Decoder has a GUI with drop-in fields and buttons and all kinds of bells and whistles. So anyway, I thought it was just, who knew that there was a master decryption key and that these guys would say, we're done. So here you go.
So
if there are any drives lingering out in the world that are still encrypted, obviously you're not going to pay us, or you would have already. So here you go. Here's your master decryption key.
Amazing.
Weird.
Weird.
Yeah. And creepy that there's like, the previous distributors of Tesla Crypt, they've all switched over to Crypt XXX. So for whatever reason, maybe the Tesla Crypt people just got tired of doing this. I don't know. Speaking of tired of doing things, Flash continues to get the squeeze. Google announced, and I presume this was at I/O last week, because this is May 15th is the date of this coverage from VentureBeat that picked up the story. Although then I followed the link to Google's, they had some kind of funky developer looking slides. So yeah, that must have been from I/O, because they also said on the slides, all of this terminology is subject to change once people with suits look at it. So to recap, last September, so September of 2015, 8 months ago, Chrome 45, Google's Chrome browser for version 45, began pausing any Flash content that was not, and I remember we had fun talking about this at the time, because Google's terminology was not central to the web page. And it's like, what? So, Google's now deciding what Flash content is important. That's good. We'd rather that they just paused everything. But in this case, you know, there are like sites that rely on Flash. They didn't want to disturb those. But, you know, things like ads. If you had a Flash ad where, you know, things were bouncing up and down and flashing in your face and just really being an annoyance, Google said, no, we're just, that's an ad. That's not central to the page's content. We're just going to pause it. And then, you know, you could wake it up if you wanted to, but, you know, we were all happy that they had put those things to sleep. So now, essentially 1 year later, meaning in Q4 of 2016, which would put us back to September again, Google intends to further squeeze this again, but this time also applying these rules to the central content as they define it, such as Flash-based games and videos. So they call this new initiative, which will happen, so we're still a ways away, but presumably in like a year from when they did the last one, so Q4 of 2016, they're calling it HTML5 by default. And again, I don't know if that'll be the final term. That was the name of this in the developer slides. So Flash Player will continue to be bundled with Chrome. So it'll still be there. However, its presence will not be advertised by default. Now, what that means is that when you've got script running on a page, there is an array called navigator.plugins and another one, navigator.mimetypes. And so script is able to enumerate through the entries in the array to determine all the plugins that the browser has and all the mime types. Mime is like .html, .mp3. You know, it's basically the type of file that that the extension represents. And so by not advertising those, that what that means is that Flash will be there, but script that checks the browser to find and launch Flash won't find it. So so what Google says is, as a consequence, sites that offer both Flash and HTML5 but bias themselves to the past, essentially, to Flash, they will no longer do that. They'll then, feeling that Flash is apparently not available, will fall back to, or actually fall forward, because HTML5 is where we're going, to HTML5 for rendering what they would have otherwise rendered with Flash. So that becomes, so as Google puts it, HTML5 experience becomes the default. Then when a user encounters a site that needs Flash Player, a prompt will appear at the top of the page, giving the user the option of allowing it for a site. So now we're getting to, you know, the do you want to run Flash on this domain or on this website behavior. So again, sort of just putting up an additional barrier. You can click through it. If you do, Chrome will remember your choice, so you're not forced to do that every time. So it'll honor whatever decision the user made, pro or con, on subsequent visits. Then there is a concern that on the very most popular sites, which are still dependent upon Flash, this would create what Google is calling over-prompting. So they will separately maintain a whitelist in Chrome of the then top 100 sites based on aggregate usage. And that whitelist will prevent that extra prompting question from coming up and just allow Flash to run. So sort of a heuristic trade-off. And that whitelist apparently will be groomed and evolve over time as sites get their acts together, finally say, okay, I guess it's time for us to stop using Flash, then and do that, Google will bring in some other site and presumably remove the one that got things fixed. Now, this is where it gets a little kludgy, because basically all of this behavior is a kludge. You know, this is not the way anyone intended the internet to work, where the browser pretends not to have services to offer, and it says, oh, well, unless you're really important, then we'll let you have them. Or if you're not, then we're going to make the user, you know, go through extra hoops and all that, okay? So as a consequence, sites like Pandora.com will direct the user to download Flash Player when it determines that the browser doesn't support Flash, which is now the facade that Chrome in September, starting in September, will be presenting. So Google doesn't want that to happen because you actually do have Flash. So somehow they're like special casing that behavior. And if Chrome sees some sites like Pandora, and I guess it's on a site-by-site basis that they're checking for this, it just sounds horrible. They intercept the request to download Flash Player, or maybe that's what they're doing. So they're able to get all sites because you get an intercept page from Pandora saying, oh, you need Flash Player to proceed. You know, click here to download Flash Player. So when you do, you click a link, get.adobe.com/flashplayer, Google Chrome will see that, will intercept and cancel the navigation, and instead present the allow Flash Player info bar, as they call it. So as I said, just a nightmare. But obviously this is all aimed at increasing our stability of the web, putting you using Chrome's power to put pressure on websites to move away from Flash. And we know that if pressure wasn't applied, all of the experience that we have of these technologies on the net, which have so much inertia, is that Flash would never die otherwise. And we all understand it's time for it to die. It's only inertia today which is keeping it going. Anyone starting from scratch now would just use HTML5. So there will be a policy setting available to enterprises, which gives them the ability enterprise-wide to override all this nonsense with always run Flash content. Now, maybe that's only, well, it wasn't clear whether that was browser-wide or just for their site, so that their own users wouldn't be harassed if they wanted to run Flash on their own corporate site. But under user accessible, that is for all of us, content settings, there will be the option of specifying how we want this handled. So we'll be able to, on a instance of Chrome basis, to select always run Flash, allow sites to ask to run Flash, ask the user to always be prompted about running Flash or never run Flash. So, you know, very much the way like cookies are handled of like, you know, keep them forever, never accept them, or keep them only for this session. Similarly, we have, you know, four different settings for how the user wants Flash handled. So, you know, I think it's unfortunate that this is what's required. I can't think of a better solution. We do want Flash to get phased out. We've got good alternative replacement technology now. And so Google is saying, okay, we're taking a stand.
People are asking, why is Twit still using Flash? We don't use Flash, but some of our providers, not all, but some of our providers do. And so it depends on what stream you're getting and so forth. But obviously, we don't require Flash because you can visit our websites on iOS and Android and watch live video. So, right. You know, some of this is a signaling issue with your browser and our site and so forth. But Ustream, for instance, if it sees that you're not supporting Flash, will give you an HTML5 stream or an HLS stream. Bitgravity, I think, is Flash only. I don't know if Twitch offers the alternative. Probably does. Amazon owns Twitch now.
Yeah, I don't think we're ever really going to get rid of it. These things just never completely go away.
We don't provide our own. We stream to these providers, and then they choose what to send you. So we don't really have that much control over it. We pay because we wanted to be on iOS. We do pay a company called Flowsoft for an HLS stream that works on iOS, and that's what you'll get on the iOS apps. But it costs us money. I don't know. I mean, yeah.
I've got a bunch of videos on GRC. I've got those, the PDP-8 videos, and then the SpinRite, what it does and how it works videos. And the SpinRite stuff, I took the time, and I don't remember now if I did that yet with the PDP-8 videos, but I know I did. I wanted it also to be able to run on mobile devices, non-flash-based devices. And so I have three different codecs, the WebM, the AUG, and
right,
MP4.
Right.
And it's really funky because you, in the HTML5, they have to be offered in a specific order, and one of them is like oddly out of order specifically because of the way iOS works. But, you know, this stuff is now available, and it's a little bit of a pain, but, you know, it's sort of where we are at this point.
Right.
And actually, we're going to talk about Cory Doctorow's posting on at the EFF a little bit later about what, unfortunately, movement we're seeing in terms of closing this down.
Good, 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 good.
So we talked back in 2012, 4 years ago, when 6.5 million email addresses and I'm doing air quotes, or no one can see it, but trust me, around the word encrypted passwords leaked onto a Russian hacker forum. And the air quotes are around encrypted passwords because at the time, and this is in 2012, still well downstream of when this was not correct behavior, LinkedIn had unsalted SHA-1 passwords.
Ew.
So, I mean, they weren't MD5. That would be worse. But still, SHA-1 had, you know, the GPU code for screamingly fast hash cracking of unsalted passwords was already mature. And what we found was we had some fun at the time at the expense of that 6.5 million users because, you know, monkey was number 12. And you know, many passwords were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then the next most likely was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. and so forth. And so it's like, oh, come on. So anyway, the news this week, and that's odd because I don't get this. Now, an additional 117 million passwords. Actually, it's 167 million, but about 50 million are missing some of the information. So there's 117 million complete email and email address and password pairs. Still, I mean, from the original breach with unsalted SHA-1. So what's so weird about this is that this is time-sensitive value. And at the time, LinkedIn informed everyone who was affected, that is the 6.5 million people whose email addresses were part of this public posting, to that, you know, that they forced a password reset. So sorry, you can't log in again. You got to use password recovery. We'll send you a recovery link in email because that we and everybody else has your email address now. And then you'll be able to update your password. They also advised all of the rest of the non-affected subscribers at the time that they should probably change their password too. Well, yeah, because apparently there's 167 million or at least 117 with full account compromise information. But again, what's strange to me is that it would have, that information, that additional 117 million was far more valuable as part, you know, like 4 years ago in 2012 as part of the original offering. I'd love to know the backstory behind, like, what has been happening for the last 4 years. Now a hacker who goes by the moniker Peace, P-E-A-C-E, is offering to sell this next batch or old batch of 117 million for $2,200 payable in Bitcoin. So what, like 5 Bitcoin? And again, the database has been looked at. 90% of the passwords were cracked within 3 days, within 72 hours, because again,
rainbow tables now, using or
in 2016, we can just cut through SHA-1 unsalted hash like butter. Yeah. It just doesn't pose any kind of a barrier any longer. And so, you know, this is interesting, too, because it's a little bit of a lesson. One of the things that our listeners have watched over the coming up on 11 years of this podcast is how the whole crypto and security industry is routinely retiring technologies and rolling forward into new ones. And of course, we've just been talking about SHA-1 and the problem with signing using SHA-1. It's very different than a password. Remember that the reason we can crack a password is that a GPU can easily guess, you know, short alphanumeric phrases and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 and things and go, oh, look, you know. And in fact, there's all sorts of ways also to dramatically accelerate that kind of brute forcing, basically sort of reversing the hash. So, and of course, the register.co.uk snarkily reports that LinkedIn users haven't learned any lessons about proper passwords. And I observe, well, yeah, except that those were all from 4 years ago. Right. So, you know, this was part of the original breach, apparently. It's strange to me that you know, something that's no longer nearly of as much value has, like, taken this time, this length of time to get back out onto the market. But what the heck? If you want to take something away in terms of an action item, if you have an account on LinkedIn, if it predates the 2012 breach that we talked about 4 years ago, and if you have a simple password and you ignored LinkedIn's advice at the time, even though you weren't one of those initial 6.5 million people, and you did not change your password, probably too late.
They all know it. It's not so much LinkedIn. It's really that if you use Monkey123 for LinkedIn, you probably used it for everything else.
Correct. Exactly. And in fact, we know there was some reporting that indicated there were people who still had an unchanged password because there have been breaches of LinkedIn accounts following the release of this database. Yeah. So it's like, okay. Again, some people just won't change their password. Allo. One of the things that we learned at Google I/O last week is that Google is jumping into the messaging chat sort of feature crazed messaging app business. And they have something called Allo, A-L-L-O, which is the name of their messaging client. I have to say, Leo, before I forget, I thought that the idea of showing the incoming video before you answer it is brilliant.
Knock, knock, yeah.
Just like the kind of things, like, why didn't anyone think of that before?
Right.
So hats off to them for that. But what we learned was that Allo would not have encryption enabled by default, that it would support encryption, but it would be turned off. And a whole bunch of people throughout the industry have weighed in on this on both sides. And what we understand is that the a lot of the features that Allo offers, like in fact, I was listening to you guys talking about it during the announcement. As I understand it, Allo is able to, in a dialogue with somebody, suggest responses.
Yeah.
And so you just choose, oh, yeah, I like that response. And you just click,
yeah.
You know, click the suggestion.
Exactly.
Well, clearly, for Google to do that, it has to see into the conversation.
Of course. Yeah.
So Allo offers users a choice. And boy, talk about some social experimentation. I'm interested to see how this comes down. So Allo will offer users a choice. Do you want to enable encryption, thus having privacy and security, or opt not to have end-to-end encryption, which then enables the entertainment and interactivity side? And TechCrunch, in their coverage of this, suggested that most likely consumers will likely choose the latter.
Well, they'll choose.
They will go for entertainment and interactivity. They want that feature over privacy and security. And I agree.
Yeah, they won't choose anything. They'll choose the default. This was the only argument: is what should the default be?
Right. Right.
I mean, Google clearly needs to see into your stuff to do all the magic that it does. It does that with inbox on an email too. It suggests responses.
Right.
And they're very good. They're uncanny because they're reading what I'm saying and they put it in my voice. They're very, very good. And I don't have a problem with that. But of course, if you see what I think Google should have done, I don't think crypto should have been by default. I think there's a middle ground where you could turn it on and it would stay on. Because right now you choose incognito per conversation. In other words, it's not a setting.
Not globally.
You say, I'm going to do an incognito conversation now. What you should have is a checkbox that says, I want all my conversations to be incognito. And they can put up a big thing that says, well, you understand, we're not going to be able to do anything we want to do.
Right.
But they decided not to do it. I don't have a big problem with that because you use Signal or WhatsApp right?
Precisely what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Was use two different messaging systems. Use the fun one that has all of the Google enhancements where you're just talking about, you know, where you're going to have a meeting and so forth. And if you have something that you need to have private, use a high security messaging app that only operates that way. The good news is where they got their encryption.
Right.
If you do turn it on, it's from Moxie and Company, Open Whisper Systems Signal Protocol that I talked about several weeks back and was just knocked over by from a technology standpoint. Those guys, you know, in terms of the design of the crypto, they for an asynchronous secure messaging system, Signal is it. And of course, that's what WhatsApp adopted. And we have a question in our Q&A later about what, you know, of all these different alternatives, what would we recommend? So we'll talk about that when we get to it. But anyway, I thought that was interesting. And I think you're right. I think, as we know, as I call it, the tyranny of the default, people will just leave it the way it is. They will like all of that stuff. And they may notice if they do bring up security that suddenly all of that extra stuff isn't there and think, oh, well, I want that.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's there if they want it. And it's kind of nice to have it as an ad hoc option. You don't have to install another messenger.
And if you kind of want to whisper to each other.
Right. You know, the tech blogs are calling it the sexting mode.
Of course. Okay.
That's where they're going. I'm excited. So, I think this, you know, I actually bought a book now on machine learning because I'm very interested in what the limits are, what the capabilities are, how hard this is to do, how it works. I think Google is smart to say we're going to reinvent search and start using this knowledge. And it depends on them gathering information about you. And
as long as
people understand that and that this is what they get in return, I think that's fine.
Yeah. Jeff Hawkins, Hierarchical Temporal Memory, HTM, is the work that he's doing. You had him on Triangulation.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Quite a while ago.
Yeah.
And Yeah, I mean, he gave us the Palm Pilot and graffiti, and I loved his notion of compromising, where the user could learn how to form letters that were still the letters.
Right.
So it was easy to remember, but they were also, it disambiguated them from all the other letters of the alphabet. Just a really a brilliant solution. And, you know, and he had, turns out to know a lot about brain science too. And, he's one of the major technology. I remember seeing the demonstration of his vision system where you were, and it sounds like the kind of stuff that Google has now. It doesn't seem like such a big deal as it was at the time. But you could show this software a whole bunch of different boat pictures and then show it some pictures of completely different looking boats and non-boats. And it would find the boats. Like somehow it's like, wow. You know, I mean, it like understood boatness somehow.
Yeah.
So very, very impressive. So, yeah, Leo, it's that's
excited.
Cool stuff.
Yeah.
So, Cory Doctorow, you had him on Triangulation.
Well, he's been on Twit many times. He's a friend of the
many
network.
Times,
we
right.
love Cory.
Neat, you know, for the people guy. So, it turns out he's really got a burr in his bun over something that's happening over at W3C. And I didn't realize it until I saw this most recent posting, and then saw that it ties into some previous ones. So and there's enough interesting specifics here for Security Now that I want to share this. So he wrote once. So this one is titled, and this is posted over at EFF, "Save Firefox." And with a little bit of an introduction here, he says, "Once upon a time, there were two major browsers that virtually everyone used: Netscape and Internet Explorer, locked in a death battle for the future of the web. They went to enormous lengths to tempt web publishers to optimize their sites to work best inside their windows and hope that users would follow. Then, a game changer, the open, nonprofit Mozilla browser spun out of Netscape with the mission of putting users, not publishers, in charge. Mozilla defaulted to blocking pop-up ads, the scourge of the early web. It was a step none of the major browsers could afford to take because publishers were convinced they would go broke without them. And any company whose browser blocked pop-ups by default would alienate the publishers who'd throw their lot in with the competition. A little over a decade later," writes Cory, "and the world of browsers is unrecognizable. Mozilla turned into Firefox, Internet Explorer turned into Edge, Apple launched Safari, and Google launched Chrome. Every one of them blocks pop-ups by default. Literally none of the dominant browsers from a decade ago are in widespread use today. Which is not to say that there isn't competition. There is, and it's fierce as ever. It's a strategic fight to please both publishers and users, whose interests are not always the same. Publishers want to gather more information on users. Users want to keep their information private. Publishers want to control users' browsing and viewing experience. Users want to sit in the driver's seat. We need competition. We also need diversity. We need the possibility that young, game-changing market entrants might come along. We need that idea to be kept alive, to make sure that all the browsers don't shift from keeping users happy to just keeping a few giant corporations that dominate the web happy. Because there's always pressure to do that. And if all the browsers end up playing the same old game, the users will always lose." So he says, we need more Firefoxes, meaning an ecosystem that encourages upstarts. He says, we need more browsers that treat their users rather than publishers as their customers. It's the natural cycle of concentration Disruption Renewal that has kept the web vibrant for nearly 20 years. And he says, we may never get another one, though. The World Wide Web Consortium, once the force for open standards that kept browsers from locking publishers to their proprietary capabilities, has changed its mission. Since 2013, the organization has provided a forum where today's dominant browser companies and the dominant entertainment companies can collaborate on a system to let our browsers control our behavior rather than the other way around. This system, Encrypted Media Extensions, EME, uses standards-defined code to funnel video into a proprietary container called a content decryption module. For a new browser to support this new video streaming standard, which major studios and cable operators are pushing for, it would have to convince those entertainment companies or one of their partners to let them have a CDM, a content decryption module, or this part of the, quote, open web would not display in that new browser. This is the opposite, writes Corey, of every W3C standard to date. Once, all you needed to do to render content by a server was follow the standard, not get permission. If browsers had needed permission to render a page at the launch of Mozilla, the publishers would have frozen out this new pop-up blocking upstart. Kiss Firefox goodbye, in other words. The W3C did not have to do this. No copyright law says that making a video gives you the right to tell people who legally watch it how they must configure their equipment. But because of the design of EME, the Encrypted Media Extensions, but because of the design of EME, copyright holders will be able to use the law to shut down any new browser that tries to render the video without their permission. That's because EME is designed to trigger liability under Section 1201 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, our good old friend the DMCA, which says that removing a digital lock that controls access to a copyrighted work without permission is an offense, even if the person removing the lock has the right to the content it restricts. In other words, once a video is sent with EME, a new company that unlocks it for its users can be sued, even if the users do nothing illegal with that video. We proposed that the W3C could protect new browsers by making their members promise not to use the DMCA to attack new entrants in the market, an idea supported by a diverse group of W3C members. But the W3C executive overruled us, saying the work would go forward with no safeguards for future competition. And he wraps up saying, it's even worse at first glance. It's even worse than at first glance. The DMCA isn't limited to the USA. The U.S. Trade Representative has spread DMCA-like rules to virtually every country that does business with America. Worse still, the DMCA is also routinely used by companies to threaten and silence security researchers, as we talk about often, who reveal embarrassing defects in their products. The W3C also declined to require its members to protect security researchers who discover flaws in EME, leaving every web user vulnerable to vulnerabilities whose disclosure can only safely take place if the affected company decides to permit it. And he said, he finally says, the W3C needs credibility with people who care about the open web and innovation in order to be viable. They're sensitive to this kind of criticism. We emphasize there are lots of good people working there, people who genuinely, passionately want the web to stay open to everyone and to be safe for users. But the organization made a terrible decision when it opted to provide a home for EME, and an even worse one when it overruled its own members and declined protection for security research and new competitors. It needs to hear from you now. Please share this post and spread the word. Help the W3C be the organization it is meant to be. And this was one of a series of similar postings where Corey goes back and looks in similar fashion to looking back at the circumstances under which Firefox was born. And he notes that we would not have Netflix today if this were the environment that a Netflix were trying to be created under. And our, you know, people who've been around, you'll certainly, Leo, remember that Netflix was under attack by Hollywood, because they were the original model was mail you movies, which you would watch and then return. And the entertainment industry hated that and tried to sue them into non-existence. And as we know historically, the same thing happened when home video recording tried to happen. Again, that was, you know, the entertainment industry tried to absolutely prevent that from happening. So so Corey notes not only Netflix, but even iTunes. iTunes was fighting in the beginning an uphill battle. The model that we have and the history that we keep seeing being repeated is that the copyright holders are, you know, it's in their nature to want the most comprehensive, sweeping blanket protection that they can get. We have to remember what's in the interest of the people, because, you know, that's the intent behind copyright is to maximize the value for the population, giving creators of content real but limited, you know, curtailed rights. And you know, it's kind of creepy to imagine that. That we're moving towards a technology where we're going to have essentially DRM pushed into browsers, and only browsers that are permitted to display that DRM will be able to display, you know, that kind of protected content.
Yeah, I agree.
So bravo to Corey for, you know, carrying the torch and
carry that torch.
Helping us.
Can we take a little break now with this?
Yes, thank you. I need to drink some coffee.
I can tell. You're exhausted. And we're only halfway through. Our show today brought to you by good friends, guys who freely say we emulated your model, Leo, but with a little different slant. Tim and Don were IT trainers. They were the guys who helped you get the certs so you could get a job in IT. And they were doing a great job of it, but they saw what we had done at Tech TV and then at TWIT, and then they went to an event that we had at NAB New Tech TriCaster folks had called Broadcast Minds, and a light went on, and they said, golly, what if we kind of did IT training over IPTV and let people watch, like on their Roku or on their tablet, on their computer, on whatever they've got, and they could get the certs. If they're in IT already, they could learn how to do it, learn how to get the certs, but also learn how to keep, you know, all the new skills, because there's always new skills. There's Tim peering over. Actually, that's Don, isn't it? And then there's Tim. I love these guys. Tim Broom and Tom Pezzette, who are the trainers there. But actually, they have a big staff now. In fact, they really have exceeded everything we ever did here at TWIT. They've now got two studios, 50 hours of new content added weekly, over 1,000 hours. If you just go to itpro.com twit.tv/securitynow and take a look at the course library. You'll get some idea of the depth they have. Certs from Microsoft and Cisco, the CompTIA A+, and Linux Plus, and Security Plus certs. The security certs from ISC Squared. Adam Gordon, you probably know that name because he wrote the book on security, and he's doing their classes. They've got great people. Project management, Apple, Microsoft Office, all the certs. You know what's so cool? IT Pro TV now is the first IT video provider with courses for sale on this new Amazon Video Direct platform. This is if you wanted to just, you know, brush up on one thing. It's still, of course, a subscription gives you access to everything. But if you just wanted one little thing, you could get that on Amazon. I'm really thrilled to see them do this. And again, this is another example of how not only are they did they do what we did, but they've gone way, way beyond. They just completed the CISA, CISA, globally recognized cert in the field of audit, control, and security of information systems. Brian O'Hara did that. You might have seen his books on the subject. The June courses, upcoming courses, CCNA Security, that's Cisco, VCP6, that's VMware, and Adam Gordon will be back to do the Certified Ethical Hacker Training. That CEH cert is a super cool cert. I would just like to do the training. This is for CEH V9. You get the HTML5-based virtual machine labs, lets you set up a Windows server and Windows clients, even if you're just on a Chromebook. You know, all you need is an HTML5 browser. The Transcender practice exams, those are free. And that's worth $109 by itself. So look, here's the deal. You pay one low monthly subscription price or save when you buy a year at a time. You get 2 months free and access to all of the library as downloadable, so you can take it with you. There's a no-hassle cancellation policy. Of course, they have corporate and group pricing. They told me when they were out here, Tim and Don told me that the entire Harvard IT department, Harvard University subscribes. So does MIT. So does UCSD. So does Stanford. itpro.tv. Now, we got a great deal for you. If you go to itpro.tv/securitynow, you can try IT Pro TV for no cost for 7 days. And if you decide to buy, 30% off using the offer code SN30. That brings the price down to less than $40 a month. $399 when you buy a year. That is a great price. IT Pro TV. We're big fans. And I've heard from so many people who've gotten jobs, the job they dreamed of, they always wanted, doing the things that they love doing anyway. And I hear from IT professionals all the time who keep brushed up on the on every bit of the material they like to know, they need to know. The website is itpro.tv/securitynow. And don't forget that offer code SN30 to try it free for 7 days and save 30% on your new subscription. Back we go to Steve Gibson and more security news. Yes, yes.
So, yeah, a couple bits of miscellany. I wanted to note that as a consequence of Microsoft's latest Get Windows 10 shenanigan, which has everybody really upset, Graham Cluley, who's been writing in the industry forever, he wrote a piece this morning with the headline, Microsoft has a dirty little Windows 10 upgrade trick up its sleeve, clicking X won't stop your PC upgrading to Windows 10.
Now, we were showing that window.
Yeah.
You can't just close the window?
No. No.
Mother
and in fact, I'm going to read something from someone we all know, and I'm not going to tell anybody who it is first. So the title was Upgrade Gate. Microsoft's upgrade deceptions are undermining Windows 10. This author says, for months now, I've complained about the software giant's heavy-handed tactics in trying to trick customers into upgrading to Windows 10. But a recent change to the Get Windows 10 advertisement that is forced on Windows 7 and 8.1 users takes things entirely too far. This is indefensible. Frankly, this entire episode has been indefensible, with Microsoft introducing a non-stoppable, non-hideable advertisement on several hundred million PCs from around the world, and then upgrading that advertisement to thwart those who do seek to remove or hide it. It has changed the language of the ad, made no clear cancel choice available, and jammed it into the recommended updates that auto-install via Windows Update. If you read this site, writes this author, listen to Windows Weekly or What the Tech, you know how bad things are. It's been a constant refrain. And this author writes, well, I've had it. Last week, Microsoft silently changed Get Windows 10 yet again. And this time, it has gone beyond the social engineering scheme that has been fooling people into inadvertently upgrading to Windows 10 for months. This time, it actually changed the behavior of the window that appears so that if you click the close window box, you are actually agreeing.
No, you're kidding
to the
me.
No. You are actually agreeing to the upgrade without you knowing what just happened.
Oh, my God.
Previously, closing this window would correctly signal that you do not want the upgrade. So Microsoft did not change the wording in the window. It didn't make an upgrade now button bigger or a non-existent don't ever upgrade button smaller. It pulled a switcheroony. It's like going out to your car in the morning and discovering that the gas pedal now applies the brakes while the brake pedal washes the windshield. What a fun commute. The violation of trust here is almost indescribable. It's bad enough that Microsoft has been training Windows 7 and 8.1 users, i.e. most Windows users, to not trust Windows 10 because of this horrible, unstoppable advertisement. But now they will not trust their own sanity because all they'll remember is that they dismissed the advertisement by clicking the close Windows box. Why on earth did Windows 10 just install on my PC? Why on earth indeed? Coupled with the growth of clean personal computing platforms like Chromebooks and Macs, and the fact that Microsoft cannot convince its own PC maker partners to not ruin the Windows experience with crapware, one has to wonder, is this all part of some plan to destroy Windows from within? I mean, seriously, you couldn't write a dumber story about how to ruin something that is otherwise as wonderful as Windows 10. My God, Microsoft, just stop. And for you Windows 7 and 8.1 holdouts out there, please feel free to utilize a third-party utility like Steve Gibson's Never 10 to hide the Get Windows 10 advertisement from appearing and prevent Windows 10 from silently downloading to and upgrading your PC. You shouldn't be treated like this,
yeah, I agree.
But at least you can stand up for yourselves. And that piece was written this morning by our friend Paul Theroux.
No, I could tell. And, of course, we'll talk about it tomorrow. So just to be clear, this window is not new. It's a terrible window to begin with because it says Windows 10 is a recommended update. And you have two choices, the OK button, which will start the installation, and where you would normally see a cancel button, upgrade now button. So that's the same thing.
Well, now, and remember that there was a previous version that had two buttons. One was upgrade now, and the other was upgrade later.
Well, that's what OK does, because OK will do it on later tonight.
Correct.
Now, here's the button you need to click. It's not the X button. It's the click here to change upgrade schedule or cancel scheduled upgrade. And it's not obvious that you want to click that link, that blue link underneath the date and time.
And it's not even underlined.
No. I mean, if you hit return, it would be okay. The thing that's upsetting Paul is upsetting, which is in every other case, hitting the X would indicate cancel.
Yes.
They're not even letting you do that. You have to, the only way out at this point is to click here and then say no. And then does Never 10 stop this particular
thing?
Yeah, you don't see this.
Yeah, it just all goes away.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's interesting is there has been a skyrocketing explosion of downloads. We're at, when I looked this morning, a total of 535,000 downloads, and we're tracking at more than 25,000 copies of Never 10 per day.
Microsoft's become the Borg.
Wow.
Resistance is futile.
And again, I'm Steve. I love Windows Gibson. This is not anti-Windows. This is anti-Microsoft. Yeah. This is like,
as Paul wrote,
and we know Paul's not anti-Windows. You know, in fact, he did a piece over the weekend. He installed a brand new Windows 7 and was tweeting through the experience. Actually, it was pretty much all day Friday. Like, I can't believe it's this slow. I can't believe I still have. He says, I'm going to go out and, you know, have some more kids and come back. And, yeah, and I'm still going to, you know, this thing won't be updated.
So we're going to make this the twit bit for this show. Patrick Delahanty is saying this in the chat room, and I agree, Patrick. This will be our twit bit, and we will put this on our YouTube Twits a Bits channel, which is youtube.com/twit. So you can link to it. It'll just be a couple of minutes of Steve talking about this, us showing the dialogue box, where to click, and the warning. And I think Patrick wants to share it with friends and family, and I think others may well as well. So we'll... This is right here, the little snippet from Security Now.
And what's sad is, oh my God, there were 232 responses an hour after Paul posted this.
Yeah.
And the first three of them were people telling stories this morning, getting tech support calls from people saying, nothing works. I got up this morning and my computer is broken, and so forth.
And one last piece to the twit bit. grc.com, is it /never10?
Yeah, that'll get you there.
/never10. The thing I want to really emphasize is Steve writes this in assembly language. It's a few hundred bytes. You download it, a few hundred kilobytes. It's right. It's a megabyte.
81.
81 kilobytes.
Yep.
You download it. You run it. It is using Microsoft's approved method. The method that they prescribe to enterprises, so that, you know, enterprises don't want to see this in their business.
Right.
That makes the edits that group policy editor would make, right? Registry changes. So unless Microsoft really gets crazy, which they could, this will work forever. And you can then delete the program. You don't have to keep the program. It's made those edits in your registry, and you're done. It will also, if you check the box... uninstall, you see that's remove Win10 files. But a lot of people don't realize is even before this comes up, Microsoft has been in the background secretly downloading the Windows 10 installer.
About 6.5 gig of Windows 10 ready to land on your
expanded,
drive.
It's giant. And so that's sitting on your hard drive right now. So there's a button on here that says remove Windows 10 files. Do that before you delete the program. And far as we know, this is not going to ever happen again. Run this Never 10.
Correct. There, with all of the instances out there, there's been no report of anyone who's run it ever being harassed again.
And that makes sense, because Microsoft's not going to cheese off their big
they
enterprise
can't.
Customers.
They can't. No. They it's like on their site. It's that page.
Yeah.
And I'm actually, the way this has turned out, I'm happy for. It's not, again, I don't have anything against people upgrading to Windows 10 if they want to. The whole point is, for whatever reason, people don't. And they should have the right to be able to control that, not to. And essentially, Microsoft is overriding their will. What I'm pleased about is that when the Microsoft documentation first appeared, we talked about it on this podcast, and it was like, you know, your eyes crossed over like trying to navigate through the registry.
And no normal and do user that. Should be asked to edit their registry. That's just a recipe for disaster.
Right.
It's terrible.
And so I stole a week from the work on Squirrel because I just thought, you know, this needs to be simpler. There was that GWX control panel, but it was hundreds of somethings. I mean, it was big. And it was covered with buttons, and I looked at it and was confused. But it's like, well, okay, all I want to do is not have this pop up. And so I thought, okay, I just got to fix this. What I'm really pleased about is that, you know, this Never 10 launched sometime, I think it was like early in March. And so it had enough time to be around and to get some traction so that now in this last week, when it's really become a problem, everyone knows that it exists. And so people are, I mean, I'm seeing tweets about it constantly. And as I said, 25,000 copies a day now. So it's
I'm going to say I like Windows 10. I mean, it's not that we're you might not like Windows 10 for the privacy reasons, but it's not so much that it's something. And I know Paul loves Windows 10. It's not so much that we're saying, oh, you don't want Windows 10. You should have the right to choose, and right. No company should ever trick you into installing an upgrade like that. It's a massive upgrade. It does break some systems. It does break some software. It should
but
not be
mostly
forced on
it's
you.
for grandmothers who are like have figured out how
makes
to use
cry.
7.
Yeah, it makes me cry.
It's not like an iOS update 9.3.2 goes to 9.3.3 right. where nothing changes essentially. The move from 7 to 10 is like, what happened? I mean, it's just like, wow. And Paul used a term in he posted over the weekend before this morning's posting, where and he used just exactly the right term. He talked about Windows enthusiasts. And I thought, yeah, I like that because that's not me. I'm a user.
Yeah.
I'm, you know, for me, it's a tool, but I get it. I mean, that. Someone could just want to play with the latest and greatest, a Windows enthusiast. And so, of course, you're going to want Windows 10. And you wanted 8 and 8.1, and you're going to follow the train. And for me, it's like, I want stability. I just want it to run my programs and for me to use it as a tool. An enthusiast here, I'm not. So, but I liked that differentiation that he made over the weekend. I thought that was really good because, you know, he is one, and a lot of people who are using Windows 10 is like, yeah, I want the latest Windows.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah, but you should get to choose.
I'll just also say that I've listened to you guys. I think it was last week. Wondering whether the upgrade would end. That is, are they going to terminate it?
And they say they're going to make people pay starting July 29th. So,
and I have to, And I have to think that with this much backlash, Microsoft can't be deaf to this, to everything that's being written. Brad, it looks like Kakos, Chacos, who's the senior editor of PC World, he said he wrote that it is a nasty trick. He said, so after more than half a year of teaching people that the only way to say no thanks to Windows 10 is to exit the GWX application and refusing to allow users to disable the pop-up in any obvious manner, now they – oh, so that they had to press X over and over again during those 6 months to the point that most people probably just click it without reading.
They've trained you. Yeah.
Wow. Microsoft – just made it so that very behavior accepts the Windows 10 upgrade instead.
Wow.
Rather than canceling it.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Oh. That's a good point. It's a nasty trick.
So anyway, I have to think Microsoft is aware of this and they're going to go, okay, fine. Message received. We gave everybody a year. No excuse. If you do, you didn't want it for free, fine. We're going to stop pushing it on you. So I have to think they'll take it away.
I don't know if there's a lot of evidence for that. People have been screaming about this for months.
So I did want to mention many people have been experimenting with the healthy sleep formula. And I have previously mentioned that one of the key ingredients, Seraphos, apparently as a consequence of the healthy sleep formula and the timing of the manufacturer choosing to drain the channel in order to replace it with a reformulated version, no one has been able to get it since for a couple months. Well, just this last weekend, it reappeared. And the bad news is they ruined it. It is not the same. It is at best 44.4% the dosage of the original at currently about twice the price. So it was already one of the most expensive. I think it was the most expensive single ingredient with the reformulated Source Naturals L-theanine in number two. There is something called Enerphos, E-N-E-R-P-H-O-S. But I'm a little worried about that too. It's from a company called T.E. Niesby, and they were once in Fresno, but I think they're gone. So I think we're in the same position of there being a stock, an existing inventory of this Enerphos, which to me looks the same as the original Seraphos. But unfortunately, if we all of us healthy sleep formula people go buy it, we're going to buy it out of stock again. Anyway, I have a bottle of Enerphos. It literally came today because I purchased it the moment I realized that it might be the same. And of course, I also have a bottle of the reformulated and ruined Seraphos, which I've already I've seen some anecdotal reports from people saying, yep, they're not healthy sleep formula people. I immediately, over on Amazon, I put up a warning that this Seraphos bore no resemblance to the 8-year historical Seraphos that all of the – there's like 233 glowing reviews of it for adrenal fatigue and lowering cortisol. And unfortunately, you know, unless this was brought to people's attention, they'd be buying this new one thinking it was, you know, trading on the reputation of the previous one. And it no longer deserves that at all. So I wanted to give people a heads up. I don't have a healthy sleep formula response yet. I will play with this Enerphos and post on the page my results to see whether it could be an interim replacement. But again, it looks to me like we're just draining internet stock from that may exist. This company appears to be gone. So I will let people know. And I'm just gratified by the amount of help this has been for people. I have no scientific study to demonstrate what the efficacy has been. I don't know whether people are sending me more positive responses than negative. I know that there are some people for whom it has been ineffective. But when I hear that 35 years of insomnia has been completely cured, the people are like sleeping, as they put it, like a 6-month-old baby, you know, through, I guess, do 6-month-olds sleep through the night? Anyway, I think of it as like sleeping like a teenager, because I think of teenagers like logs.
Yeah, you're like sleeping like a teenager, yeah.
Anyway, so it's worked for, I don't know, maybe 90% of the people who played with it, and the change to the Source Naturals L-theanine was a big help too. So I'm just happy that it's been of use to so many people, and I will tweak it when I have some more information.
Our lawyers have asked us to say that Steve is not a doctor, and you should consult your physician before taking any supplements.
Oh, and I should mention, many people have also written saying they did go to their doctor. And their doctor has been very impressed.
But ask your doctor.
Yes.
I'm just saying, because you may be on medications they're not on, et cetera, et cetera. So before taking any supplements, always consult your physician.
So I'm a little embarrassed about what this person writes, but it's kind of true. So I decided, well, okay, even though it embarrasses me, I'll share it. This is Kurt M. in Southern California somewhere. Who the subject line, this was written on the 20th of May, so what, 4 days ago. He said, my personal experience with an old friend, Spinrite. He says, dear Steve, in the 70s, you would call the TV repairman to replace the tubes in your TV. They were expensive and went out often. In the 1980s, computers were much the same. Hard drives, though more reliable than floppy disks, for anyone who still remembers, that's not saying much. As a young man in the 80s, I spent many an hour working in computer repair. The problems were many, from Compaq, the Mac 128K power supplies, to 30-megabyte Seagate RLL drives, which were really just 20-megabyte drives with a different controller. Drives of that era were not just very reliable. Over the course of my lifetime, I have repaired hundreds, if not thousands, of hard drives. You know how many times after all those years SpinRite failed me? He writes numeric zero, then the word zero, nada. Wow. To me, he writes, SpinRite is the rock of Gibraltar. I've always felt that if you know SpinRite, you know the man behind it. I believe it was a labor of love, and it shows in the end product. And if you love what you do, then you understand in intimate detail the principles of what makes it all tick. It's clear that you do. Thanks for giving the world a product they can truly trust. I can attest that with SpinRite, you can trust it like an old friend. Respectfully, Kurt M. So,
isn't that nice?
Kurt, very nice.
That's very nice. Yeah. All right, Steve, we got questions. You got answers. We've got commercials. You've got to take a break. Go have a cup of coffee or something.
Perfect.
And I'm going to talk very quickly about Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Push button, get mortgage. I love that. So if you've ever done the mortgage thing, ever bought a house or refied, you probably have some experience with the mortgage in the home loan industry. And I think the one word that leaps to mind is paperwork. Lots of it. This is a better way to do it. In fact, next time we're buying a house or refinancing, this is absolutely the way I'm going. Quicken Loans. They call it Rocket Mortgage because it brings the approval process into the 21st century. It's fast. It's completely online. All right? The reason they're advertising in Security Now is because they know, you know, signing a document and faxing it is not the most secure way to do it. They've moved it all online, and that includes uploading bank statements, W-2s, W-4s, everything you need, all the paperwork, all can be done online. On your phone, your smartphone, on your tablet, as well as on your computer. And it is quick, it's easy, and you can completely manage it without leaving your couch. And I love that. Rocket Mortgage. So if it's time to refi, if it's time to buy a new home, or, and I want to, they never put this in the ad, I want to emphasize this, as somebody who's bought quite a few homes now, you know, like five homes over the last 20 years, the best thing you can do in this seller's market is pre-qualify. Go right now. Website is quickenloans.com/securitynow. That way they'll know you heard it on the show. quickenloans.com/securitynow. Pre-qualify. That puts you at the head of the line of buyers. If it's time to buy, time to refi, it's time to pre-qualify. quickenloans.com/securitynow. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLS. ConsumerAccess.org. Number 3030. NMLSConsumerAccess.org. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support. Again, quickenloans.com/security now. All right, Steve, let me get the PDF up on my screen, and I'm going to get you some questions. You ready to answer some?
Yes. Yes. Coffee refilled.
Yes, coffee refilled, mug to the brim. Starting with Joel Davis. He's coming to this question and answer session via the Twitter. He says, and I quote, regarding Z-Wave and Zigbee security, while I fully agree that a fully secure home automation protocol would be ideal, looking at the current state, what would be easier for a thief? Hacking the protocols with a software-defined radio or just kicking in the door? I'm not a fan. I don't disagree. I'm not a fan of letting the perfect be the enemy of the good enough.
Yep. And I like that because it sort of brings us back to earth.
Yeah.
You know, we've been talking for the previous 2 weeks about some of the details of IoT security, looking first at Z-Wave and SmartThings, and then also Zigbee security. And it's worth remembering that, yeah, we're talking about in many cases a door lock or alarm or security systems. But in terms of gaining entry, we've all got glass windows. And if somebody really wants to get in, can be done.
Yeah.
You know, so anyway, I don't think it's black and white. It's certainly different if you could walk up to the door and twist the handle and walk in. You know, that's an unsuspicious action that that anyone observing you from the street would lead them to believe you had rightful access to that facility, whereas kicking the door in or throwing a brick through the window makes it pretty obvious that you don't live there.
Yeah.
Or if you do, you have a real problem forgetting your keys inside the house.
You have anger issues.
But again, I appreciated Joel's note because, yes, you know, it's easy to, and I think we often do this, for example, in the, when we're talking about crypto. You know, you raised the point, Leo, a very good one a few weeks ago. It's like, yeah, you may have end-to-end encryption that is just bulletproof and it's got ratcheting and Moxie Marlin Spike has given it everything he's got. Except if you've got a keystroke logger, game over.
Yeah.
Because it's logging the keystrokes you type before the encryption and everything. So, it it's necessary for us to keep some perspective on all of this. And so I appreciated what Joel said.
Brian in Carlsbad, California saw the return of the dreaded 303-5583. Steve, you mentioned some folks saw the Windows update KB303-5583 coming back. So did I on my Windows 7 machine, despite running April 18th's version of Never 10. I also noticed many other updates and no longer being able to trust what Microsoft says. I looked it up and KB315-0513 is also purportedly for Windows 10. So I unchucked that box too. What's the deal, my friend?
So this, I like this question because we've gotten of a lot of questions. We've gotten, we've received.
Received.
What happened to my English?
We've gotten many questions from all of you people.
We've received many questions. People are confused because they assume that Never 10 is going to prevent this 303-5583. It's going to remove it and prevent it from coming back, which is not the way it works. During the development of Never 10, I looked long and hard at doing that, and Microsoft, for whatever reason. It's an area where normally Microsoft has very comprehensive, expansive APIs that give you incredible granularity and control into the operation of things. Yet, oddly, that's missing from Windows Update. As a developer, and I dug into it, there's no way to say to Windows Update, I don't want this update. You can't even have something running in the background that like filters through them. So it would have been a real kludge where it would have seen it already arrive and then, you know, had to like invoke some sort of removal tool in the background. There was just no good way to do it. And it wasn't necessary. It's easier just to let it come in and set the registry keys to which it checks, and it goes, oh, shoot, I can't do anything here. And then it just sort of sits there limp, not bothering you any further. And we presume after the end of July, maybe Microsoft will take it away. They'll just remove it. So I wanted to make it clear that Never 10 doesn't prevent these things from coming in because I would if I could, but there just isn't a practical means of doing that. Instead, I just tell it, don't do anything once you get here. And it's not very big. I think it's 30K.
And I got to presume that, they're going to honor.
I think they're going to clean it up. I think they'll remove all this junk from
29th.
People's systems.
Yeah. And they're going to honor what they told enterprises. They're not going
to
maybe downloading stuff, but they're not going
to. They have to.
Well, you know, it's a new day. I don't recognize this Microsoft.
Boy, that would be a bridge. That would be a bridge too far, I think. Well, we'll hope.
Herschel Day, Houston, Texas, wondering about the security of video baby monitors. Steve, Maybe you've covered this before and I can't find it, but there are a lot of articles posted about baby monitors being hacked. From what I can tell, this is mostly with Wi-Fi-based devices versus the radio devices. I've only recently become a parent. The little one's 5 months old, and this is obviously a concern. What prompted this search was I currently have a radio-based monitor. It was given to us as a gift. It seems to be interfering with the 2.4 gigahertz band on my Wi-Fi, which has my Ring doorbell and a few other things on it. I then began to look for something that wouldn't interfere, and I found these issues. Should I just get a Nest Cam and forget all this, or am I safe, or what? I should point out one of our fans earlier today said he bought a security camera on Amazon, didn't like it, returned it, but he'd already installed the software. And a couple of days later, he started getting notifications from the camera, and he's looking into somebody else's bedroom.
Oh.
They did. Yikes.
Oh,
we are really in a brave new world here.
So we discussed old school video baby monitors way back in the early days of this podcast. And so I thought, that's interesting. I have not brought myself up to speed lately. And I was pulling this all together last evening. So I did some looking around, and what I found was so horrific that I thought, okay, we have to, can't wave my hands around and say, oh my God, oh my God. Because the details that are available are just chilling, and they make such fabulous content for this podcast that we're going to talk about it next week. So, and those are Wi-Fi internet enabled. The security firm Rapid7, who we've talked about often in the past, analyzed the security of 9 baby monitors. 8 of them got an F and 1 got a D. But again, the details are just so juicy. Very much like what you just said, Leo. I mean, that was a perfect lead-in for next week. So way back before IoT, when not everybody even had Wi-Fi, baby monitors were what Herschel Day has now. That is, they were 2.4 gigahertz. They were analog, but also had some sort of encryption. And back at the time, we were talking about how it wasn't great encryption. The problem was it didn't have enough entropy. So somebody who knew what you had could essentially explore all of the possible settings for the encryption key on that links the transmitter to the receiver and find your video. But that pales in comparison to anyone on the planet being able to look at your bedroom antics. So, Herschel, I think you should stay with what you've got. And this Rapid7 report was just in September. This is just only a few months ago. So it's not like it's, you know, back when LinkedIn was losing its SHA-1 unsalted passwords. This is contemporary. So we're going to talk about the details next week because, it demonstrates a complete disconcern with security, which is, as you said, Leo, the brave world that we're in at the moment. Now, the Nest Cam may be okay. I mean, those guys certainly understand.
Yeah.
I'm sorry?
It's Wi-Fi.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's Wi-Fi, but I mean, when you hear what is available on the market that people are buying when unwittingly, and how easy it is.
There's also radio receivers. I mean,
well, that's what Herschel has.
No, but I'm saying there's radio interception devices as well, but they have to be proximate to your
house. So, exactly.
You're not putting it on the internet.
Exactly. Yeah. And today if I had to choose, I would either use a Wi-Fi based camera whose security you really understood. Now, I've got here the Ring doorbell, and somebody wrote that it was necessary to open map six ports through their router in order for the Ring to work. I will be researching this when I get mine installed.
I didn't have to do that.
Okay. Yeah. He may have wanted, instead of using UPnP, maybe static port mapping. I don't know. But anyway, so I'm still, mine's still in the box.
Yeah, I'm curious what you think. Yeah.
I'll be taking a look at it. So I would say if you can take responsibility in some fashion for what a web-enabled camera, for the security of a web-enabled camera, then okay. But boy, based on the study of baby cams that are, contemporary baby cams, it's just amazing how bad they are. It's like, you gotta be kidding me. So Herschel, I'd stick with what you got. Somebody, as Leo said, proximate to your house who really wanted to could, because typically they're encrypted. There is a key, so there is some security. They all advertise security. It's not great security, not nearly as good as Wi-Fi security, but boy, it's not available anywhere on the planet.
Yeah.
And the Shodan search engine isn't immediately finding you, every baby bedroom on the planet where you just have an analog camera. So, we're just in a rough time right now. I'd stick with an analog device the other possibility is if you could find one that was functional without needing the internet, that is where the internet wasn't part of its feature set. Unfortunately, they're all offering, view your, baby's crib anywhere, like while you're at work during the day. So that, of course, means the signal's leaving your house over the internet. And boy, they just haven't cared at all about protecting their customers.
Yeah. Eric in Sweden wonders, why is my proxy not breaking SSL? Stephen, Leo, as usual, great show and all that. I started listening around episode 390. I've also gone back and listened to episode 1 through 300. So I'm almost caught up. I've run into something that's puzzled me for quite a while. I set up a proxy in Germany to make it look like traffic from domains I choose come from that country. And the strange thing is, it works perfectly. Or to be more precise, it works perfectly with SSL. I tried using google.com with SSL through the proxy, and I searched for my IP, and Google showed the IP of the proxy. And not ISP, my ISP's IP. By the way, that's the search, my IP, and that works quite nicely on Google. But I was at the same time connected to Google.com using SSL, and everything was green in my browser. Well, wait a minute. Shouldn't a proxy break SSL? I guess he's using Squid because he asks, does it have some built-in magic that makes proxying SSL possible?
So, great question. Because we often talk about how, for example, corporate proxies on the corporate intranet border are having to play all these games in order to intercept HTTPS connections in order to see into what traffic is coming into the network. Squid, as an example of a popular browser, like many proxies, has the ability to leave the session alone. There's a command called connect on a Squid proxy that brings up a tunnel. And any protocol can simply tunnel through without needing the protocol to be broken. That is to say, the TCP packets, which carry SSL or TLS now, they will go to the proxy's IP, and it simply rewrites the IP header on the packet, changing it, changing the destination IP from its own to where Eric is in Sweden, and then drops that packet back on the net. Now, that same packet that went to the proxy now goes to Eric. So essentially, it sort of bounced through the proxy, but it wasn't ever opened up. And so proxies can inspect traffic, which, for example, they would have to do if they were going to cache it. There are caching proxies that, must then look at the traffic. But it's also possible for it simply to be an IP-level proxy that doesn't go into the higher-level protocols. So all it does is it changes the source and destination IPs and puts it back on the internet, and so it sort of just bounces the packet through it. That way, anybody who is outside, like Google, saying, you know, what's this user's IP, they see the IP of the proxy, when in fact, those packets are then being forwarded to where Eric really is. So, you know, that's how it works. Proxies don't necessarily inspect the traffic. They're able simply to forward it. And that's what's happening in this case.
Mike, question five, in Chicago, wonders which secure text messaging app to use on his Android phone. I'm trying to decide once and for all which secure text messaging app to use. Seems like Signal Private Messenger from Open Whisper Systems is the way to go, but Telegram? Question mark. Oh, boy. What are you guys currently using on your iPhone Android phones?
I thought this was an interesting question because, you know, we get – I see these kinds of questions coming in all the time. Which one should I use? And he's saying, I'm trying to decide once and for all. Well, it's such a moving target.
Yeah.
You know, here Google has just introduced or announced Allo, which wasn't an option, and it has all these features and optional security on a per conversation basis, as you told us, Leo. And remember also that a messenger is inherently part of an ecosystem that is whoever you're messaging has to have the same one. Because we don't really, at this point, we're not at a level, maybe we will eventually be, but currently we're not in a standards mode. You know, everyone is stovepiping and hoping to capture the market for their own private messaging protocol. Maybe if something like Signal created interoperability, that is, you know, Signal being a great protocol around which many people could agree, then maybe that could allow different messaging apps to interconnect. But at this point, you can only talk to somebody who's got the same thing on the other end.
Right.
So the decision is not an easy one.
Android has one advantage, though, Steve, that you're not familiar with because you use iPhones.
Okay.
Which is that you can name another arbitrary messaging system as your text, as your SMS messenger, as your default messenger. Just as you could say, I want to use Chrome or Firefox as my default browser, you could tell Android, this is my messenger, which means text messages will come through there. Now, you're not going to get the security unless the other person is using the same messenger, but at least it can become your default messenger, which is kind of, I think, a good choice. You can't do that with Apple. You have to use messages. So you're exactly right that if I'm going to use Signal, for instance, and I make Signal my default messaging app, anybody I want to have a secure session with has to also be using Signal.
Right.
But
right.
At
Although
least it
I
is.
Do have, on iOS, I have green and blue balloons, and so I'm able to do messaging to non-Apple
but
users.
Surely you're not proposing that you think messages is as secure as, let's say, Signal.
Oh, no, 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 no.
No, no.
No.
So
no, in fact,
we know it's not.
I've been, you know, leading the charge that unless people manage their own keys and right. and authentication, there's, you know, you have encryption, but you really don't have provable
right.
security.
Right. So
yeah, so anyway, to answer
say,
Mike's
what
question.
Do you like? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what
see,
I'd love it if if anything that used Open Whisper systems was interoperable.
Right.
That would be awesome, but I don't think they
right.
Are they?
No. As far as I know at this point, they're not because they all want to, you know, do their own thing. So, for example, in Allo, again, we're still at an early stage where the various messengers are all hoping to acquire like a market share and maybe win in the long term. Mm-hmm. And so we have complete fragmentation, and it's the fragmentation is increasing rather than decreasing. So anyway, to answer Mike's question, the optimal solution, first of all, I think it's too soon yet to arrive at something. But if you truly need secure messaging, then remember that the other end has to have the same thing that you do. And for me, there's nothing other than Threema. I know that it's not open source. It is open protocol. Yet, so we're trusting them. They seem trustworthy, but you are managing your own key. The alternative would be a signal-based solution, because I love the signal protocol that Open Whisper Systems has created. Although there, you do need to take the initiative to verify the identity of the other end out of band, that has, you know, through some other means. And we talked about that a few weeks ago. And turn on that off by default notification if the user's identity ever changes, because it's stored locally, and there's an option to alert you if something like a man in the middle were starting to intercept your communication, which you wouldn't otherwise know. So, I mean, the fact that you wouldn't otherwise know it, that's kind of problematic for me. So, again, it's all a bunch of trade-offs. I just feel like it's still too soon. It's like it's all, you know, up in the air. People want security, but they also want convenience. I think the Allo experiment is going to be very interesting to see how many people really care. It's like, no, I'd rather have Google giving me features and listening.
Threema's got that big advantage of the, you know, matching up and the three dots and all that stuff, but it's close.
And they're cross-platform.
But it's closed source, which frankly, to me, is a non-starter. I think, you have to use an open-source solution. And that's why Signal's the way to go. It's a little weird because we don't know exactly how WhatsApp has implemented it. So we have to take their word and Moxie's word that they implemented it.
I also heard something disturbing about Signal, and that is that that they're claiming license required in order to use it. So it's not open source, and you can't actually use it without their permission and without a license. So I'm afraid that Open Whisper Systems has gone a little commercial. I don't blame them. It's their right because they've got beautiful IP. But still, it's like, that's unfortunate.
I just went over to check the EFF's secure messaging scorecard, and they've actually taken it down because they're working on a new secure messaging guide because things have changed so much. You can look at version one of their scorecard, and all of these checkboxes will give you some idea of what you're looking for, including open source and whether it's been reviewed and, you know, if there's an audit and so forth. And there aren't that many that are 100% green checkboxes all the way. Chat Secure plus Orbot is one. Off-the-record messaging for Windows using the Pigeon app is another. Signal, Red Phone, Silent Text, those are all from Whisper Systems. Telegram, Secret Chats, they give all green to. You're not so fond of it. It's open source, but it's using a non-standard encryption suite, one of their own design.
Yeah, Matthew
Green
tweeted something about it a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. who would ever use this?
Right.
It's like,
Text Secure. I like that one a lot. Text Secure is quite good. You see, Threema loses one check because it's not open to independent code review. So, if you go to if you Google EFF Secure Messaging Scorecard, you can see the old one, and I can't wait to see
resource.
The new one. Yeah, it'll be interesting. Moving on, question number six comes to us from Xi'an, China, where the Terracotta Warriors are. Lee writes to us, you mentioned in a recent podcast or two that Windows Update was getting very slow. FYI, it looks to me like they've moved the anti-malware scan from after the installation to the start of the downloading part of the update. Oh, that's interesting. That's the that's the Microsoft spyware removal tool or software removal tool. Hence, there's initially a long period of 0% downloaded, no network activity, and nothing appears to be happening despite a busy CPU. That's interesting.
I thought this was a really interesting observation. I shared it with Paul this morning. We corresponded back and forth about it. And so I've not confirmed it, but I wanted to share it with our listeners because I know we have a ton of techie listeners and everyone has been observing something seems to have – something really bad seems to have happened with Windows Update where it just like takes forever now. And so it's worth looking at maybe digging down to see where the processor is busy, like what process it's in at the beginning of Windows Update. If this observation is correct, then it would explain that it's like, especially on an older, bigger system where there's just a lot to rummage through, if they're doing a pre-update like MRT scan or a Windows Defender scan, you know, like a full system scan, that takes a long time. And I've watched it sitting here like with no network activity, like what is it doing? Like just and I was assuming, as I wrote to Paul, that it was building a big dependency tree because, boy, I would not like the job of having to engineer Windows Update and manage all of the different overlapping updates that replace this or that file and like filter through that and somehow figure out what set of updates this system needs. That's just over the course of time and with so many files being updated and replaced, that's just a horrific task. And so the way to do that is by building some sort of a data structure of what updates are available and which have been applied, and then granularly which ones are replacing which files to figure out what you should do. Not an easy task. I've just been assuming that's sort of what it's doing, but it sure has slowed down in the like recently, and they may have changed the logic. So I just wanted to share this so that our listeners could explore that on their own.
Yeah, good theory. Interesting theory. Paul Konigsberg in Great Falls, Virginia, wants safe browsing or wants to know about safe browsing in a VM. Steve, I'm a medium-term follower of Security Now for the last 3 years. On several of your recent shows, you've mentioned that safe web browsing should be done in a virtual machine. I was wondering if you could give more guidance, as you did with the Three Dumb Routers show. I'm currently using The Flying Turd, Windows 10.
He wrote that. I appreciated his humor.
Do you have a recommendation for a good VM for Windows, or should I look, as Leo would suggest, to go to some flavor of Linux? If yes, which flavor, which hypervisor? In either case, how would you get data, mostly files, from the web browsing VM to my machine that I care about, the one that does my banking and hobbies? I'd appreciate any guidance. Paul Konigsberg.
So, I pulled this because not because I have an answer, but because I will promise to have an answer. I think this will end up being as interesting and potentially as important as, you know, the Steve's Dream Machine was back in the early days of the InfoWorld column when I like worked out all of the details of like here, choose this motherboard, these drives, this controller, blah, 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 and gave a clear explanation of why I had made those decisions. I can't do it yet because that waits for me to move over to Windows 7 where I have enough memory and it's feasible to run a VM at the same time as my main system. But I still think that's the ultimate solution is we have to have true high-level containment of the web browser as the major, element that contacts the internet, and it's the conduit through which so much of these problems flow. So, it is a on the burner as something that I want to work out for myself, and I will absolutely share it with everyone and provide all of the basis for my decision. You know, it's going to want to be lean, easy to bring up, a small footprint so it doesn't gobble up lots of memory, so that in the VM will be some sort of very small operating system, enough to give you networking and run the browser of your choice. and then also be able to provisionally communicate across the VM boundary. As Paul notes, there are times when you do want to be able to move a file out of that container into your main system and vice versa. So it remains to be resolved, but it's something we need.
I'll be very interested to see what you come up with. Of course, you know, VMware is probably the king of virtual machines, and they offer free player-only solutions. There is a free one from Oracle they bought when they got Sun, VirtualBox.
Yep. VirtualBox.
Yeah. And then a number of people are suggesting, and this would work, this is what I do, would be I'm not that nervous, but if I wanted to be really secure, I carry around a read-only USB key, or you could put it on a DVD, and you could either put your choice of Linux distros on. And I use Tails, which is an intentionally secure version of Linux. You put it on a USB key, and you pretty much have a secure environment there. That's pretty hard to.
Well, yeah, but you got to shut down your whole world in order to.
Yeah,
yeah. It's like that's not happening.
Nowadays, machines boot pretty fast.
Yeah.
It's not.
Well, I have a mature environment of Windows up. I've got, you know, logs that are running on a 24-hour basis and all kinds of stuff. So for me, it's like.
Too.
I've got two big, you know, Firefox windows with 290 tabs open right
you
now.
Don't want
so.
To close those, huh? I like to reboot once in a while. It's just me, though. Carl Westfield, Indiana, he says, I already have a real router. Steve, a week or two ago, you were talking about a device that senses when your internet goes out and reboots things. Your response was, get a real router. Just wanted you to know, I have a nice Netgear cable modem, but every day or every several days, my Comcast internet goes out. I could wait for an hour for it to come back or reboot my cable modem. I can't explain it. I just know it works.
So many people responded that they had this problem.
Yeah.
And I thought about it, and so he has a real router, but he says, I have a nice Netgear cable modem. So, and that when he restarts his cable modem, his internet comes back. So it's like, okay, Carl, there's a problem with your Netgear cable modem. I mean, it's not that the cable is out. It's that the Netgear cable modem stopped being a cable modem, and you know it locked up. Who knows why? But if rebooting it brings your cable connection back, then that's the problem. That doesn't happen for most people. But I will say it was surprising in response to this how many people responded that. You know, they have DSL or they've got cable or satellite or whatever, but their stuff is dying and they're having to give it a swift kick every so often to get back on the internet, which is, you know, it's unfortunate. My stuff just sits here and runs for months. I mean, like forever. It never has a problem. So I do think that equipment can be a little bit marginal and also it can be power line, for example. There is flaky power in various areas of the country. Now, I don't know about Westfield, Indiana, where Carl is, but you know, if you've got, you know, some big industrial motor starting next door that pulls the power down briefly, gives you a bit of a brownout, that can be all it takes to cause some of this equipment to hang. And so it may just be, you know, that the device itself is okay, but through the power supply, it's getting glitched and causing it to hang, and that could also be a cause. So, I guess my point is, you could put up with this kind of behavior, but you should recognize that a lot of the world isn't, and that you can probably diagnose it if you care, or you can just, you know, get one of the power reboot plugs and have it restart things whenever the internet dies.
You know, that's two states of mind, and a lot of users just kind of grind along with marginal systems, put up with it, and then there's people like you who don't put up with things and say, I'm going to figure this out, and even if it takes some days and you pull all your hair out, they don't want to, you know, grind along with a suboptimal situation, right? You got it just so.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And I think we're done. We got two questions, but they were both squirrel, and I will we'll talk about them next week.
How's squirrel going? Going well?
It's going well.
Okay.
Yeah.
Baby monitors next week?
Yes. Yes. We have to talk about some of these details. They're just our listeners will love them. And it's a great cautionary tale. So
yeah.
And I'm sure we can come up with a great title for that one.
I'll leave it to you. You'll find Steve at grc.com. That's where he hangs his hat. That's his website. That's where you can find this podcast, 64 kilobit audio transcripts and more. You'll also find SpinRite, the world's finest hard drive maintenance and recovery utility. Steve's sleep formula is there. All sorts of stuff. grc.com. It's only one thing you have to pay for. That's SpinRite. Everything else is free. That's your ticket to entry. Although there is no ticket, so nobody's taking the tickets anyway. grc.com. If you have a question for Steve, you can leave him a question there at grc.com/feedback or on Twitter. He's at SGGRC, and his DMs are open. So you can DM him, or if you want to ask in public and get a public answer, SGGRC is his Twitter handle. We put the show up on our website, twit.tv/SN, as quick as we can after the show is done. We are going to put a Twitbit up with that all of that information about the Windows 10 and Never 10. Wow. And wow is right. You'll find that at twit.tv/specials. We, of course, put this show on YouTube. There's audio and video at twit.tv/SN, or subscribe. That way you'll get it every week. And there are podcatchers on every platform, and all of them have Security Now. You might have noted that we were not nominated in the podcast awards this year. There's some dispute over what happened. I maintain I received a letter from the organizers saying you are no longer eligible because you've won so often, so you are now a legacy podcast. They say, oh, that was just Twit. You could have entered anybody else, but since you didn't get nominated. I have nothing but a disdain for the podcast awards. I think they're exactly what's wrong with podcasting. We've been stripped of awards in the past because they didn't want to give us an award. Now they've decided we're not eligible. They sent us an ambiguously worded email 2 months ago. Now they're saying it's all our fault. This is exactly what's wrong with podcasting, ladies and gentlemen. It's small time, so... You know, I know we have in the past we'd said we're not going to bother with it because we've won enough. We don't need any more.
Yeah.
But for them to say, oh, you can't win is like.
Pfft. And our listeners know what content we're offering and couldn't be any more solid. We're closing in this case, the case of this podcast, closing in on a year 11.
Yeah.
So there's no pod fade happening.
Right.
You know, we're here for a reason.
Yeah. So just because I know last year you wanted to win, and I just want to let you know that's why your name doesn't show up.
And in fact, I saw that it was happening, and I just shrugged. It's like, we have our followers.
Yeah. That's about it. Thank you, Steve. We'll see you next week. We do the show every Wednesday about 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. Tune in live. We'd love to have you.
Thanks, Leo.
Bye-bye.
Security.